An unsilent woman speaks up for herself and for change. She uses her voice and owns her story to create culture and community, fearlessly and unapologetically. Hi, I'm Purva Miller. Join me as I talk to trailblazers and changemakers about questioning the status quo, building success, and creating a life that truly inspires. So grab a cozy beverage of your choice and get comfy. This is the Women in Our Town podcast. Is language truly subjective? When we speak or communicate, what is the responsibility of the listener to try and understand what we are saying? And if we were to live and speak authentically, I mean really authentically, would we be heard? I explored these questions today with my guest, actor, writer, and director, Catherine Eaton. We talk about her debut film, The Sounding, and the many themes it examines about the subjectivity of language, the subtle ways in which humans communicate, and what it means to live a different life. Welcome, Catherine, to the Women in Our Town podcast. I'm so excited to have you here and to discuss your directorial debut, The Sounding, which has been on the festival circuit for a while and is out now. It's such a profound film. The Wall Street Journal called it, and I quote, a fascinating and often beautiful communique in code from the far side of silence, which I think is actually really cool that you're on this podcast because it's a podcast for unsilent women. So yeah, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here and to be talking to you.
It's such a stunning film to behold. David Kruta's cinematography is dizzying and breathtaking at the same time. For me, I almost felt like I was transported to Heathcliff's moors in Wuthering Heights. And your mastery of Shakespeare is exquisite. I cannot for the life of me know how you could just keep up with all of that dialogue, but it's such a testament to your mastery of your craft. And you tackle quite a bit in a relatively short time. The duration of the film's a little over an hour and a half, I believe. And so,
yep, 93 minutes.
And 93 minutes. Exactly. So, what was the genesis of this film? What inspired you to write a film like this?
Yeah, so there's a few things. I mean, there's on the broader level, these were things that I was curious about anyway. So around the idea, I was already interested and sort of compelled by the idea of otherness and the idea of empathy as a courageous act. And I was also a practicing Buddhist at the time that I was writing the original story for this film. And so that was something that was really, in terms of the exploration of language and the idea of attachment, those were things that I was really interested in. Liv goes from being silent to then weaving this acquired language out of Shakespeare's words. And something that I was curious about was the idea of seeing language as language, as opposed to, I use this example when I've been on the festival circuit talking about this. I've used this example before, but we frequently take language as the thing it is, mm-hmm. right? So meaning, for instance, if somebody says, I love you, we go, oh, they love me. Right. That's wonderful. But the act of saying that is an action, and that's wonderful. Yeah. But the actual act of love is this, I think it's this cumulative, act that happens over time mm-hmm. and is over and over and over again shown in the little moments, right? So that's how I see it. So the language itself is still just language. It's beautiful, but it's language. And having a character, a woman who is using someone else's language and reappropriating it and using it to mean what she needs it to mean creates this extra level of having to recognize that this is language as opposed to action. And what's the difference? So one of the quotes that Liv uses in the film that is from Shakespeare mm-hmm. is action is eloquence.
Yes.
And that I think sort of sums up a lot of the, what I was curious about around that idea. But there's also a very specific sort of story that happened, which I'll try to keep short here so that it's not too long for everyone. just around my own curiosity and what, and how the character of Liv was born was, I had been working as an actor. I had not directed before and I hadn't, written ever. And, I was full-time as an actor. I was classically trained and I was a stage actor, but I was also starting to do some film and TV. And I was out in Los Angeles and I got this phone call that, my mom, you know, was, had fallen down on the ice in Vermont and was going to need surgery get better. And my brother had a full life and a job that demanded him to arrive there. And my sister was in college. And so I was sort of the natural choice to go home. And I thought I would go home just for a few weeks and it ended up extending and extending and extending. And the time that I was in Vermont, I wasn't acting. So I was working on this farm. And during that time, you know, as time was going on, as winter was falling, as the snow was falling, I came back from the farm and I was in my overalls and I was covered in dirt. And I had dinner with my mom and then helped her to bed. And then I was just craving language and poetry. So I pulled out my complete works of Shakespeare and I started tearing the pages out of the pieces that I loved and hanging them on the wall. And full disclosure, it wasn't my only copy of Shakespeare, but I started to see connections. It's really well known that Shakespeare has thematic connections, mm-hmm. right, around madness and around language and around speech and around action. And, but I also just started to wonder why I needed that language so badly in that moment, right. What it was about his language, but also great language, mm-hmm. right? And universal experience. What it was about that I craved. And then the character of Liv was sort of born from that because I thought, what happens if someone needs this language so badly that it's the only language they choose. And then she was born. So
that's amazing. And, you know, the point that you made, the first point about language is often mistaken for action, or I mean, almost universally, we take language as it is. And that has never occurred to me until you just said it, because it's true that, you know, language is how we express the actions we've already taken, but there's this giant process that's happening constantly in the background that isn't even being spoken. So one of the things I thought about when I was watching the film and is that, you know, Liv is speaking Shakespeare and Shakespeare is English, but there's so much opposition to it. And how is that different from somebody speaking, say, Spanish or another language? Why are we, you know, why is the character of Teddy Sears plays Michael. Why is he so opposed to Liv speaking? If she was speaking Spanish, this wouldn't be an issue. If she was speaking French, this wouldn't be an issue. Why is it that she's speaking English, but a different form of English or English that isn't spoken colloquially, such a barrier to him being able to, or to anyone being able to understand her, where she's coming from?
Those are all great questions and also great thoughts too. The idea of one of the things that I'm really personally interested in is that idea of, you said so much happens in, you know, underneath the words or that silence in the words, mm-hmm. right? And the idea that the language either represents what we've already done or what we intend to do.
Right.
And that thing that happens under language is so valuable. It's such an incredible connection and there's a truth in it. Mm-hmm. That language can't erase or make comfortable.
Right.
You know, and we use it to do that. We use it to fill it in. But if you take the language away, that actual union, let's say, or meeting of two different people, mm-hmm. whatever, you know, whether it's their intellects or their sort of minds or their full beings, but that meeting of two people and what's really happening there becomes really apparent very quickly.
Right.
Right. How comfortable are you in that silence? And what is happening underneath all the language that we're using to try to communicate our ideas and help somebody see what we're thinking? So I'm super interested in that. And I love that was something that you were thinking about when you were watching the film. In terms of why, I love the thought that if only they'd just gotten a translator for her, it would have been fine. I love that thought. I think that the question for me around this is, why, what is it that scares us, right, as a society? And some of it is necessary because some of it is about the society trying to preserve itself, right? And we need our social contracts to be able to interact.
Right.
So we need to know that if we go to a restaurant and we buy the meal, we're going to stay and pay for it. And when we don't do that, right, when we pull a runner or whatever, then that's problematic,
right?
Because then people don't get paid, food can't be bought in the future. There's all kinds of issues with that. That social contract has been broken,
right?
So, and there's subtler ones, of course, but we need those social contracts to make society happen in a functional way. Because if I just went in the restaurant, grabbed the food I wanted, which would be my impulse, right? My kind of my more primitive impulse.
Right.
I'm hungry. Those French fries look amazing. I'm just going to grab them and eat them. And then I'm going to leave. Yeah. Then we can't function together, right? We can't function as a collective. And so that idea that society needs to protect our social constructs that way, and that it does it as almost on its own in some ways, mm-hmm. without individual agreement, is really interesting, because it's almost like it's its own sort of living creature, because it wants to survive, right?
The
society and social contracts want to survive, when we get to the point where something threatens that area is what I'm really curious about, because I think it's a place where there's a huge amount of discrimination that happens.
Right.
We use the idea of social construct. We use the idea of safety and protection as ways to discriminate, to exclude, to hoard, to hoard money, food, resources, power. Mm-hmm. Those things we use that as a way in saying that it's on behalf of, you know, an organized society, a society
protecting.
That can function, protecting and our ability to work as a collective. And I think that there are huge gray zones inside that area where what happens if we make space for something that's different. So around Liv's language with regard to Shakespeare, I think that it's threatening and dangerous, right? It feels dangerous to someone who doesn't understand why she's doing it. So we immediately want a reason.
Yes.
We want to know what it is, what the reason is. And for anybody who's ever been confronted by someone who isn't following our social protocols, right? It happens a lot on the subway in New York City.
Right.
You'll be on the subway in New York City and someone will enter the train who is not following the social protocol of sit down, don't make eye contact, don't talk to people, right?
Yeah.
And they start talking to you, or they start talking to the train car, or they start talking to themselves.
Yeah.
And the walls that go up and the sense of, I now don't know what this person will do.
Right.
And now I'm scared.
Right.
Because if they're willing to break that little, if they're willing to transgress in a small way, maybe they're also going to transgress in a big way. And I think we just have to be more courageous. I think that we are not, you know, we aren't showing courage in the face of difference.
Go ahead.
Oh no, please.
I completely agree with that, because, you know, it's, when you were talking about the social contract, I was thinking that if we want to live in a truly diverse and multicultural society, we have to accept that there are people, lots and lots of people, that have grown up or abide by different social contracts than we do. Yes, there are some universal social contracts, but I remember, as an example, when I was a kid, my parents took me to watch a film that parodied an Indian person going to the United States. And, you know, they'd grown up in India and suddenly they were going to the United States for a job or for college or what have you, and how they were navigating that space. And they would go into a grocery store. I mean, this was a parody. It was a joke, but, and not a kind one to the subject, but they would go into a grocery store and they would try to haggle the price. And suddenly, like you said, the walls would go up and everyone would be really, you know, weirded out that somebody was transgressing from this is the price, and this, you buy it, you pay for it. And, but again, people live in a world where social contracts are different. In many parts of the world, it's completely acceptable to haggle for the price.
Absolutely.
It's
and not only acceptable, but expected, right? So the sort of price that's stated is not what is ultimately anticipated to be received.
Right.
I love that. I love that sense that simple transaction, yeah. right? The difference between walking in a shop and haggling or even just challenging something
right.
can then suddenly make everybody uncomfortable that's there. Yeah. You know, it's a really, that's wonderful. And it's those tiny yeah. things that create, just like you're saying, they create the butt of jokes, they create stereotypes, they create assumptions,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And then we paint pictures about what kind of person that is.
Absolutely.
Based on our own standards yep. and mores and what we've already yeah. accepted,
yeah.
right? And this is where we get into a really dangerous territory. Like, for instance, speaking about women, right? And gender equality and people who identify as women, that idea of, you know, and this is very common. I'm not saying anything that has not been discussed at length, right? So this isn't a brand new idea,
yes.
but the idea that an assertive woman suddenly becomes bossy,
absolutely,
you know, becomes
yeah.
witchy,
yeah.
becomes, and then you start to mitigate your power and your way of handling being in a powerful position as a result of the expectation people have around you because of what they had been used to.
Right.
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 And even if what they had been used to is not healthy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's so those kind of dangers are things that I'm really, it's a huge part for me of this movie is the hope that if when people watch The Sounding, that they will, I don't want them to see a message and I hope that it doesn't have a message in it, but I hope that it asks direct questions
right.
around the idea of what if we made space for this? Why are we afraid of this?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
this is a tiny thing in some ways.
Yeah.
Why are we afraid of it? And also on a more complex level, where are we responsible? Where are we as the collective responsible for the individual's actions,
right?
right? So where are we responsible for the idea, where the film asks this is around the idea of can Liv continue after her grandfather passes away, which is a small spoiler, but not a big spoiler. Can Liv continue to function on her own in this capacity,
yeah.
right? And is society then responsible for her if she doesn't want help and isn't asking for it?
Absolutely.
What happens then? So I'm really curious about that too. And I don't have answers. You know, I think every case is probably extremely different. Every mm-hmm. human being is probably extremely different. But I do have a lot of questions around it, you know, because when we start to take away the more we as a collective make decisions for individuals, the more that we start to decide what is considered included in the collective and what gets expelled from the collective. And then the more we're controlling the choices of every person that's inside that collective. And then what does that do? If you look at something I've been thinking about a lot lately, because I've been talking about the film a lot lately, but is, you know, biodiversity,
yeah.
right? If you look at an ecosystem,
yeah.
it's stronger the more diverse it is.
Yes.
So it's very, very weird
yeah.
that we have decided to get incredibly tribal
yeah.
and that we're only going to protect the things that are just like us.
Yeah.
It's a very weird way to behave.
It is. Yeah.
It's not reflected in nature. So, I mean, certainly there's an argument to be made that, you know, a pride of lions behaves a certain way and so forth and so on. But
right.
but in all, on a larger
right.
sense, which we're talking about
yeah.
a global
yeah.
level,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
we're talking about what is the biodiversity
yeah.
that we need
yeah.
to stay healthy on a biological level, of course, but also a neurological
yeah.
level. And also then, you know, in terms of like psychoproperties.
Culturally.
And
it seems the more our world has expanded, the more tribal we've become, the more afraid we become. It, you know, we expanded
yeah.
for the economic possibilities, but for some reason, our brains and our hearts and our mindset didn't catch up to it. And I feel like we're almost in a space of regression right now, and we're trying to kind mm-hmm. of clamber our way out of it. So I think it's really important that we're having these conversations. And, you know, to your point about women and gender equality, for me, and this is my take, it's a very feminist film in a lot of respects, because there are patriarchal undertones. That's how I saw it, in that, you know, up until Liv is sort of protected by her grandfather, who's her advocate, she's okay. And then there's all these men that are suddenly, except for Roland, who's her grandfather's lawyer, but there's all these men that are, that can't seem to understand where she's coming from, and almost in a way become her jailers until they can come to terms with who she is. I don't want to say her condition, because that's problematic in of itself, but in coming to terms with who she is. So that was my reading of the film. And I wonder, was that a conscious choice? Is that kind of what you were thinking? Or, I mean, yeah, I know art's up to that interpretation, so.
No, and it is, but and I love that interpretation of it. There's definitely, in the creating of the film, and I co-wrote it with my partner, Brian Delaney, but in our writing of the film, and then ultimately in the shooting of the film, there definitely is the we didn't want to limit Liv's difference to just the language she chooses and her behavior, right? That difference, that extreme form of otherness is kind of the term that we use for it, but this extreme difference that she chooses to live by, right? First in silence and then in this acquired language that isn't accepted, can be a stand-in for lots of different kinds of marginalization, and whether they're self-imposed or self-chosen, self-selected, or whether they happen as a result of birth or condition or genetics or whatever it is, right? But so many people are marginalized in one form or the other, and this functions as a stand-in for that. But one of the things that we were exploring directly was the idea of gender and how in a subtle way, you know, it isn't a coincidence that it is a team of predominantly male doctors,
right?
Because that is the truth of the world we explored when we did the research for this, but also because it did function in a different way, right? It also functioned in terms of what happens when, in particular, a woman chooses something so extremely different. Yeah. And extreme being relative, of course, yeah. Like you said, it's a different language. So is that extreme? But she did choose silence for a long time as well. And that in some ways can be more threatening, perhaps,
yeah.
Because she had the capability to speak and was not doing that, right?
Yeah.
So that was definitely there. And she is definitely standing up to the authorities that are around her, right? The people that are in positions of power around her. And those people that are in positions of power, predominantly male. What is really interesting to me is that then the film, in our screenings of the film, what has happened is it was seen very much that way, right? From a feminist perspective, which it's a huge part of my life and exploration as well, right? In many ways, just personally and professionally in terms of being a female director and things like that, right? You're constantly kind of dealing with pushing back the boundaries that have been preset for us, right? But what was really interesting, so it was seen very much as a political film in some places, sometimes specifically around gender and the gender that we established in the film, the sort of gender bias we established in the film, where Liv is the person that's being fixed by this team of mostly men.
Yeah.
But it wasn't to paint them and just to be clear, it was never our intention to paint them. I mean, my co-writer is male.
Yeah.
It was not our intention to paint them in a negative light. It was our intention to show the many different, let's say in this case, men in authority and their different responses and their desire coming from a place of good intention.
Yeah.
But then in some cases that's effective and beautiful, like in the case of her grandfather. And then in other cases that is, ends up being toxic and limiting and destructive.
Yeah.
And there's this cycle that happens where the lessons her grandfather learned become the lessons that Michael either does or doesn't learn by the end of the film. And we have to find out what happens there. But the thing that happened, so we screened the film in Istanbul, at the Istanbul Film Festival. And it was this really extraordinary, opportunity. We had three screenings and they were all sold out, and there were these long lines afterwards of people coming to want to ask questions, and it was a very mixed audience, right? Secular, Muslim practicing, Christian practicing, men, women, all different ages,
right?
And what we found was they saw the film as a very political film about rebellion and revolting against an authoritarian system, not necessarily as a woman revolting against a male system, although more of the women in the audience definitely responded to that.
Yeah.
And, but they, and especially because the week that we screened there was the, they had just made it, a law that women could not perform on stage. So it was a particularly kind of poignant because of course, when Shakespeare wrote his original work, women couldn't perform on stage.
It was, men in costume.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it was, and then of course, and that was fully accepted and celebrated. Right. And then it became stigmatized as our, as we went on and wanted to sort of define gender norms in a different way. So that's, you know, already, but that was really interesting to me. And then when we screened it at Maine International Film Festival, which was a total joy and a delight, it was 800 people opening night in this beautiful opera house that had been turned into a cinema. It's just an amazing festival. The people are extraordinary. And of course we shot the film in Maine. Mm-hmm. So not there though, not where we screened it. But you know, it was, it, as a result, we had, you know, people were interested in it and it was a very, you know, there was a, it was a very, I would say male skewed audience, right? There were more men than women at this screening.
Right.
And afterwards, they all saw it as a stick it to the man film. They saw it as one person standing up for their individual rights against a system
of oppression. That's amazing.
Which, of course, they've experienced because there's they have, you know, it's economically depressed area.
Yes.
And so I was thrilled about that because I thought they didn't see it as a critique of, you know, something they couldn't perhaps relate to, or it just moved me that the idea of one person being oppressed can stand in for oppression everywhere. And that then hopefully that raises questions in the audience's mind about different forms of oppression. Right.
Yeah.
That's what I hope.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's amazing because mental health is, you know, a running theme of the film only because this happens against the backdrop of an institution. And for me, I was reminded how mental health has so often been used against women as a means of control and as a means of taming a willful woman. And this goes back to ancient Greece. I mean, there's, you know, the wandering womb was described in a gynecological treatise of the Hippocratic corpus diseases of women as something that was entirely a supernatural female phenomenon. Hysteria is a great example as well, you know, which Freud considered to be exclusively a female disease. And I think that women have historically been considered to be vulnerable to mental disorders, whether supernatural or, you know, degenerative. And I think it's great that people were able to maybe see this as beyond just, you know, see it as an individual's experience as opposed to just a woman's experience, but everyone has their own take on it. And I think, you know, using the example of Istanbul, of course there's cultural context as well. And then Maine, a different cultural context. So that must've been really interesting for you to kind of just see how different audiences are responding to this and what their takeaways are. My question is, why does everybody, or well, the team of doctors predominantly, why does everybody feel so compelled to diagnose Olivia? Why do we need to slap a label on what her condition is, what her situation is, instead of just accepting that, well, okay, this is somebody who's maybe different and sees the world differently and understands the world differently?
So I think that there are a few different reasons in the film that this happens. And I think on a case by case basis outside of the film, there are a few different reasons this can happen, but it's kind of a two-part question because the question is, A, when she's not in a psychiatric hospital, are we still trying to label her? Mm-hmm. Right. And why? And I would offer that in the case of the film, I think that there is, an impulse to take care of her, right. Yeah. Which goes back to your question before of, could she be seen to take care of herself?
Yeah.
And I think it's easy. I want to also offer that I think it's easy for us to say, of course, she should be allowed to do whatever she wants. Mm. But also if you think about, you're living on an island way out at sea And this person you've known since she was a child suddenly starts to speak this random language that makes no sense to you. Yeah. And also the person she lived with who loved her and was sort of her, could have been, appeared to be her provider in many ways, is gone.
Right.
Do you leave that person alone? And is that the right thing to do? Right. Or do you step in and try to figure out, is she okay? Does she need help? Maybe we should call an expert, right? Those are kind of the questions that become, that come up, I would say. And then it changes from the point of view of, once one is potentially in a psychiatric hospital, there is the stages of trying to figure out how to get them out.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Or do they need to be kept there for their own safety or the safety of others?
Right.
Do they need to be kept there long term?
Right.
And that, then there are, the way our mental health system works, there are labels that need to be applied in order to figure out treatments.
Yes.
In order to try to find a path towards rehabilitation, we'll say in quotes. Or healing, right? Because there are definitely this, and I very much, I say this often when talking about mental health with regard to this film, Liv is non-neurotypical, but, there are mental health crises and they are real.
Right.
This isn't to say, oh, we should just, you know, I hope that the film asks questions around that as opposed to sometimes, people get so protective of Liv that they're like, people should just leave people alone and they should just be allowed to make their own decisions. But of course, there are real cases where people do need real attention and medical professional help.
Right.
And that help, by and large, we did so much research for this film and we had advisors on the film, neurologists and psychiatrists. We went to psychiatric hospitals. We were allowed onto the wards. I was very, very lucky at the access that I had and also the expertise that lent themselves, these medical mental health professionals who lent their expertise to the film, both at the script stage and in the production stage, because I didn't want this to be some sort of stereotype or, I wanted it to be a genuine representation within the bounds of, this is a, you know, fictionalized form, it's not a documentary, but a genuine representation of what could happen under these circumstances. And many of them have said, you know, most people who come into this profession come in because they want to do good and a lot of good gets done, but there are, we don't know everything.
Yeah.
We don't have every solution. And sometimes practices are outdated. And also it's very hard to label conditions when they present uniquely.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then how do you figure out what needs to be done? Is a person fine to be? And then of course it's on you.
Right.
If that person is potentially presenting as self-harming or harming others and they get released out into the world and they self-harm or harm others, there's a sense of responsibility that comes with having been the person that signed those release papers.
Right.
So it's a complicated,
absolutely,
you know, place to sort of sit, you know what I mean? And that was interesting to me too, because I thought, you know, it also, there's this issue of a tipping point. When we hit a tipping point and we say that person they do have a condition that needs to be cured. Mm-hmm. Then this system of processes comes into effect and it's very hard to get off that train.
Right, right.
You know, which is how we get people who are institutionalized for lifetimes and you know, that those things start to happen. So,
you know, and I think obviously you've done so much research on the film and perhaps my thinking on this is an oversimplification, but you know, there were points in the film where I had that same sort of impassioned response where I was like, we tolerate such bad behavior from so many people that I would deem to be absolutely, you know,
crazy.
Like very problematic. And that's okay. But somebody that's just slightly veering from our understanding of how a person should be or communicate in the world that we live in the narrow confines of our own mind, of the constructs we have in our own mind, and everyone's in a tizzy about it. That to me was, you know, very frustrating, which is a good thing because you want your viewer to feel. And I definitely had those reactions, but
it's a great point. I mean, we see behavior that, let's just say, contradicts our social agreements or, you know, is purely sort of fictionalized, you know, sense of self or things like that. We see this kind of behavior in people publicly all the time.
Harmful behavior.
And so what are the things really harmful? Yeah. And so what is the standard that we've set for what's acceptable and what isn't acceptable? But I do think that by and large in the mental health community specifically, certainly in terms of the intention of becoming involved in the mental health community, it comes from a place of, is this person a threat to themselves or to others? And that is the basis by which people can be involuntarily committed, right? So that's where that kind of comes from. But then to your point, when someone's public behavior is harmful and is harmful to others and it's seen and it's visible and then they aren't held accountable for that, What does that say? What does that tell us? Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's a big question and maybe a whole other movie.
No, I would definitely tune in for that because, you know, I was also thinking about this, you know, the concept of, you know, communication and how we communicate in the world. And like, you know, coming back to our original point about language, English is a universal language, but there's so many people in the world that don't speak it. And I've been thinking a lot about this as an example for myself. I have a very ethnic name. It's the root of which is in Sanskrit. And my whole
life, amazing.
Thank you. But my whole life, I felt very self-conscious about it because I didn't live in a part of the world where it was a common name. And so I was always very aware that, you know, people are going to mispronounce it. I don't want to put it on a resume and then people are automatically going to maybe, you know, form an opinion about me or have an impression of who I might be, and it might even hurt my abilities out in the world. By abilities, I mean, it might hurt my opportunities out in the world. But the more I've been thinking about language and the more, you know, we're grappling with so many things in the world right now, as an example, Kamala Harris, you know, vice president elect, she's talked about having an original name and having to, you know, that it's the onus is on the person who is receiving the information to try and understand it. It's not always on her to be the one that's constantly correcting people. So
yep.
I use that as sort of this like long-winded example to ask, do you think the onus of responsibility in understanding somebody is on the communicator or on the person receiving the information? What are your thoughts on that? Because if we want to live in a diverse society, we are going to encounter many people that may, you know, English is not their first language. If they speak English, it may not be, you know, as fluently as we do, or it might be with a different accent. And at that point, what is the onus on us to try and better understand, because they're already making an effort to communicate?
Right. It's a great question. And I think a complex one. But I would say my initial response is not a very satisfying answer, which is I think it's shared.
Yeah.
Because I think all communication is a shared experience, right? If the listener, even as I'm talking to you or you're speaking to me, if I wasn't working to understand what you were asking me, right? Mm-hmm. Whether I understood the question fully the way you intended it, right? But if I'm not sort of seeking to really take in what you're asking me and the quality of what you're asking me, then it's very easy for me to not hear you, mm-hmm. right? To not actually answer you. And then we're not actually communicating. And of course, there's much more profound minds than mine have investigated philosophers and great, thinkers and have investigated the idea of that we can never truly communicate, mm-hmm. right? There's that idea mm-hmm. as well, that the great tragedy of human existence is our isolation, right? Because our mind can't be communicated directly mm-hmm. unless there is true telepathy. Mm-hmm. Our mind can't be communicated directly, and language is an inexact means of communicating the thoughts in our mind, which is why I love filmmaking, because it includes image. And I think that takes us another step towards communication, but we try, right? And isn't that what's so beautiful? There's this fantastic musician, Irish musician. And now it's breaking my heart because I can't remember his last name. His first name is Martin. hopefully it will come to me. But he was in this fantastic talk called We Need to Talk About Ireland, which was a sort of State of the Union address to Ireland, but from thinkers and musicians and artists, right, and so forth. And full disclosure, my writing partner was also one of the speakers. And he talks about that the beauty of musicians and fiddle playing, he learned over years, right? He's extraordinary, and he's played with incredible symphonies and the best of the best. Right. And he said the true beauty in a musician is not the perfect note. Mm-hmm. It's the reach for the perfect note.
Yeah.
And some of the most beautiful playing he's seen is in the intention of the players in people's kitchens, yeah, and in, you know, little pub sessions, right, with local people that aren't, you know, haven't rehearsed and, and aren't, you know, haven't been able to spend 8 hours a day practicing because they have farms or they have jobs or, yeah, what have you. But he said their will, their desire to reach for the perfect note is what's so extraordinary and beautiful about the music. And I love that as a metaphor for communication, yeah, and discussion, yeah, right? And any form of communication as well. Body language, subtext, all of that. Mm-hmm. If we both reach for each other,
yeah,
then something beautiful happens. Maybe we don't get the exact idea. Maybe I mispronounce, you know, Kamala's name the first few times, mm-hmm, I say it, mm-hmm, but I'm not afraid because I'm living in a world where I hope, yeah, what it would be ideal for me is I'm not afraid to talk about her.
Yes.
Because I'm living in a world where someone will help me.
Yes.
If I've fallen, if I've stumbled,
yes,
a little bit.
Yes.
You know, it's a little bit like how you said at the beginning of this conversation, if I can reveal this, that if I was to stumble over an answer, I can say, yeah, stop, and we'll go back on,
yeah,
that answer.
Yeah.
It's that sense of someone's going to hold me up if I reach.
Right.
And then that encourages me to reach. So I think about that with regard to communication.
That's, you know, that's a really beautiful thought, because you're so right. And, you know, if communication was perfect, my husband and I speak the same language. So often we're talking at cross purposes and we're not understanding each other. And I think, you know, people can universally relate to that in relationships and marriages. And
absolutely,
it's communication is not just language, and it's the reach for trying to make the other person understand and trying to get your point across. And to come back to an earlier point you made, when you said this, some philosophers have said that ultimately to exist is a very lonely experience. And I mean, just thinking about the film, if that were the case, and I'm just going to be a little profound here, or try to be, I think, what a beautiful thought to have a mind that maybe reaches beyond the narrow confines of the social constructs that we live in. If we could all live in a space that like that, if existence is so lonely, then I would rather live in a mind where, I don't know, the world is a little bit different.
Yeah,
right.
I agree. And I think even
I'm exploring.
And I think even if it is, ultimately, even if we were sort of to give those philosophers their due and acknowledge that ultimately perhaps it is the tragedy of human existence that we can't truly communicate in the kind of communion that we wish for, as in like becoming one,
right?
Even if that is true, which the Buddhist in me disagrees with and sort of believes in non-duality and that all things are one,
yeah,
so to speak, even if that is true, there is still the striving.
Yes.
And that's gorgeous.
Yes.
Even if you know that you're doomed ultimately, yeah, to failure, what a beautiful thing to walk around going, I still want to,
yeah,
I'm still reaching for you.
Yeah.
And then in the process of that, we have the extraordinary gift of what it is to be alive, right? Mm-hmm. Because failure is a part of the full experience of life. And so,
yeah,
even if I reach and I fail, it's a, you know, that can be a beautiful experience as well. Although you get your bumps and your bruises along the way, of course, but I do think it's imperative in our communication with each other, because I think that it is what allows us to change,
right,
honestly, as a society and also as individuals, if we are not afraid, mm-hmm, that if we fall, we will be ostracized,
right,
if we, and that, you know, in a, so if I was to reach out to try to connect to you, to say something to you, and if I fail, you're going to shut me out. It's going to stop me just on a primitive level because we need each other to survive globally.
Right.
There are very, very few people who are able to, and I am intrigued by those humans that have gone completely off the grid and live completely isolated lives. But many of us not only depend on each other, but also cherish each other, right? And love the human connection. Right. So if I know that by reaching out to you, that it's, I'm not going to be met with being excluded if I fail, but that I'm going to be met with someone reaching back and going, you know, how about this?
Yeah.
Here's the thing.
Yeah.
And then I go, oh, great. Now I can take on my responsibility to understand what it is you said, what that means and where I go from there. And I think that's so important. So,
I mean, I completely agree with you. It's the entire human experience is to keep trying, right? It's sort of the opposite of what Bukowski said when he said, don't try. And then he tried his whole life. Which was like, well, okay. So I completely agree with you. So, you know, you talked a little bit about filmmaking briefly. We touched on it, and it's such a beautiful film. I can't stress that point enough, how visually stunning it is. This is your directorial debut. What part of the filmmaking process do you enjoy the most? What do you love about filmmaking? Do you, you know, love to get your thoughts on that?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for saying that about the movie. I'm very grateful when I look at it. I feel very honored by the other collaborators I worked with, and just that it's this sort of the most amazing thing about making a movie. And I would wish it for everyone. You know, I wish that everyone would have the privilege and opportunity to do it. It is also the hardest thing I've ever chosen to do myself, right? It's not the hardest thing that's ever happened to me, but of things I have self-selected, this is the hardest. But it's the more rewarding as a result of that. The thing that I love about it is you have this sort of idea, this germ of an idea. And it's particularly if you're the writer or co-writer, in my case, of the original script. But even if you're not, you have this germ of an idea that's inspired by your own imagination in some way. And then you bring on this village of people and you hold the space for this vision. And that sounds very lofty, but there's very practical ways to do it. But you hold the space of this vision that you have. And then they all contribute their amazing imaginations and incredible expertise, right? From costumes to lighting, to obviously the framing and the camera work, to locations, to of course the actors and the incredible, like the humanity that they bring to each character that even in your wildest imagination, you couldn't have imagined that moment, right? They bring all that and suddenly it becomes this exponentially extraordinary piece of work. Whatever is good in it comes from all these imaginations meeting, being met by all these imaginations on this thing. And then you look at this accumulation of all that creative and imaginative work and experience, of course, and then that becomes the finished product. So it's a really special form that way. And of course, that means that holding that vision in a clear way and knowing what you see so that all of those artists can bring their best work and do their job on the set, it becomes incredibly important. So it's the biggest adventure anybody could ever have is directing something, in my opinion. I mean, it's one of, let's say, I don't say it's the biggest, but it's certainly one of the most extraordinary adventures anyone could have, because it's using so many parts of who you are as a human being. You know, it uses your intellect, it uses your management skills, it uses your obviously hugely your creative skills, your visual skills, your instinct, being able to tap into your intuition and your sort of subconscious, but also then being able to articulate that in a very real world way around cameras and lenses and shot angles and shot lists and setups and breaking down scenes into beats and objectives and needs so that you can work with your actors. And then actors all come and they're amazing. And of course I came up as an actor. So my sort of the part of directing that came with more affinity, I'll say, or more quickly to me is directing actors, because I had been around so many and I love them so much, and I have been and continue to be one. So, but actors come with their own approach to the work. There's many different ways to do the kind of strange thing that acting is. And they all have their needs and whatever those needs are, and they have their questions, and you have to find different language or ways to inspire them and bring them to the moment that they need to be at, from the time that you call action to the time that you call cut.
Wow.
And that's just like beautiful. It's like life distilled into this sort of essential form where you're fully present and every part of you is being used. So it's an amazing job.
It sounds incredible. I can't imagine it's without its challenges. And, you know, what was maybe hard about making the film? What was hard, and what is hard about filmmaking? Because movies are kind of where we all go to escape, to be inspired, to try and understand someone else's experience a little bit. And there's so much that goes on behind a film. I mean, I remember hearing a TED Talk once where Pixar credits the babies that were born during the process of a film being made because it takes a village. So I can't imagine that it's without challenges. That, you know, what are some of the hard parts of filmmaking?
That's wonderful. I love that. Yeah, because it's, and also timing is such a huge part of when your film comes out into the world and how it's received and things like that. I think that there's a lot of challenges. I mean, there's a lot. It's very challenging work in the best sense of the word, but it also depends very much on, you know, the scale of the movie you're making, who your community is. When I started directing, I had an incredible creative community around me of human beings, but I didn't have other director colleagues, right? I had worked with directors as an actor, but I was a little bit reluctant to sort of call on them too much during the sort of early stages of realizing I was going to direct this film and then learning how to direct, right? And kind of setting up, you know, I shot a short film as a lab for myself, and I was just stealing information and ideas and ways and methods from everything, every source I could find, whether it was books, which I read tons of books because I'm very kind of nerdy on directing, by famous directors and by little known directors and by non-directors and by cinematographers, right? But then also, you know, I watched tons of YouTube video, and I did talk to everybody that I could talk to, but I didn't have, now I have friends, close friends who are other directors, right? Very, very close friends who are other directors, including female directors and female identifying directors, which became important because there are some challenges that hopefully will disappear, but that are specifically related to being, female or female identifying director, or probably a trans director as well, or a non-binary director. I'm sure those were facing certain challenges that are different.
Right.
And I just didn't have that resource initially, and I didn't know how to get it. It wasn't something that was on my radar at the time of how to sort of, and that I would need it. And so initially, directing was a thrill, but it also can be lonely,
right?
Because you are holding that vision, and sometimes you're holding it with your jaw locked and you're braced against the wind and your head is down, and it's solely by your tenacity and will that this thing is getting made.
Right.
That does happen at different stages, and that this thing is getting made the way you see it.
Right.
And of course, the ideal is which also happens when your collaborators are all on the same page and you're seeing everything the same and everybody's being paid and everything, you know, and people are able to do their best work, but that isn't always the case. And so, so that is a hard time when you're sort of shouldering it. And I was lucky because I had a personal community around me that was so supportive. But that can be, and directors talk about this, the loneliness of the job sometimes that can happen. And so it's a real delight now to have communities of directors and dear friends who are directors to be able to sort of talk about the time in the trenches with. It's a pleasure.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I think that's really challenging is just the duration of the experience, particularly you know, if your first feature is an independent film, there's a real, you have to have real tenacity, and then it goes on. Mm-hmm. It doesn't end when, you know, the shooting stops. It doesn't end when the edit stops. It doesn't end when color correction and color grading stop, right, and when titles are up and when picture is locked and when ADR has finished and when sound design is there and the composition is there and the picture is completely finished. It goes on.
Yeah.
You're still finding a home for the film. You're still going to festivals, and festivals are amazing and an absolute gift, but they are also, there was a period of time where it was practically a full-time job, right? And we were lucky because we were getting into a lot of festivals, and those festivals were wanting female directors to be there. And so they were creating situations, paying for flights, you know, bringing you around the world, which is a gift to anyone. But also you'd get there and you wanted to serve the festival. So you were, you know, doing work while you were there. You were doing Q&As and panels and going to the screenings and helping to advocate for the screenings and the festival itself. Yeah. And that, I know now why there are directors who don't go to festivals, who aren't, refuse to be involved in distribution, because you then aren't able to, you're having to squeeze in the time for your other work, whatever that is,
right?
For how you make a living, whatever that is. And for me, you know, I was sort of having to stagger acting jobs, which was at the time predominantly how I was making my living. And then I was writing new scripts and I was having to stagger those.
Right.
And that period was truly exhausting. Right. It's a gift because obviously it's a privilege to have the challenge, but it's a long, long road. And I think that that's not always evident when you start, but then isn't that kind of the joy, is to sort of go, well, I didn't know this, but here I am and now I'm figuring it out. Yeah. And then, you know, obviously as you move on with your career, things change, you get bigger teams, you know, you have bigger, you have more support and some of the, you know, the longevity of the projects, it begins to tighten, right? And that is going to be wonderful. So, but it is it's a journey. So
that's amazing. I think what a beautiful film you've created at the end of all of it though. And what a treat it is. I've just finished my third watch and we'll give it a week and then maybe watch it again. And then I'll be beating your mom out for the number of times I've watched this movie. But
that's so kind of you. I honestly, and all of that being said, like, I wouldn't exchange it for the world, and I really do wish it for everyone. There's nothing, you can't even kind of communicate what the experience is to have had this imaginative idea and now to have people interacting with it in the world.
Yeah.
And they have their own relationship to the film, like you have your own relationship to the film, and because we can have a conversation about it, you know, that becomes more shared. But there are people who have watched the film that I'll never meet and I'll never hear from.
Right.
And they have their own private relationship to it. And that's just what an amazing
thing. Yeah, that's, you know, that's amazing. And I do agree. We develop relationships with films over, you know, there's a reason some films are so dear to our hearts and we go back to them over and over and over again, or at certain times we go back to a certain film because, you know, it speaks to us in the moment. I mean, Christmas movies is a great example. We watch them every year. I can say the words to Home Alone off, you know, on beat, and I'll still watch it every year. I mean, I know what everything that's going to happen, but it's not about watching the film again. It's about the relationship you develop with it over time and what it's, exactly, what it means to you. So, you know, I think it's, you've created an incredible piece of work, and I think everybody should watch it and form their own relationship, their own opinions, use their own language to understand it, process it silently or through the written word or the spoken word, however someone chooses to interact with the film. I think that's amazing. And
Thank you so much for
talking to me today and for,
oh, it's a total pleasure,
sharing your thoughts. And I you know, hope to see more work from you, acting, directing. I mean, it's all amazing. I couldn't believe that I could understand Liv throughout the film, and she's silent for such a big part of it. And so, you know, that again, a testament to your expressiveness and your ability to communicate through your craft.
Thank you. Thanks so much for saying that. I really appreciate it. This was a total blast. So I'm delighted to keep talking about it.
Thank you so much, Catherine.
And I love hearing from people too. Yeah. So if people do listen to this and they want to reach out, it's a joy for me to hear back from people. So there's contact information on the website and thesoundingfilm.com. And, you know, I love hearing from people who've seen it. So this is a gift.
That's amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. The Sounding is available for streaming on Amazon, Apple TV, Prime Video, Google Play, and several other streaming services. You can learn more at thesoundingfilm.com. We've been quiet on the pods over the last few weeks as we went through some big life changes, but we're back on a regular schedule now. Our next episode is going to be a little different because I'll be sharing some of my story. I'll be talking about why my partner and I moved to Costa Rica, what went into our decision, and what was the catalyst for us to change our lives so drastically. As always, if you enjoy the content, please consider subscribing to the podcast. You can read stories on womeninourtown.com or follow along on Instagram and Twitter at womeninourtown.